This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of issues every week as seen through the lens of sustainability. It is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. It is hosted by Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher, and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Broadcast every week on Otago Access Radio and podcast on sustainablelens.org and on oar.org.nz.
Welcome to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher and me, Samuel Mann. Each week we'll talk with someone making a positive difference and we try to find out what motivates them and what it means to see the world through a sustainable perspective through their sustainable lens. Tonight's sustainable lens is that of Christian Remy from the University of Zurich. We are in a conference centre in San Jose. We know the way to San Jose. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with the big questions. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Germany, in a very rural area, very close to the Netherlands. And then I graduated from the University of Aachen, RWTH, Aachen University actually, in a very technical discipline of computer science.
What did you want to be when you grew up?
Oh, so many things. I don't know. I've always had an interest in history and stuff. So actually, like, I don't know. Archaeology at some point was really interesting, which archaeology was an interesting thing, which was the reason why I ended up taking 6 years of Latin that now are completely useless. I don't know. Then making stuff, inventing things sounded to be interesting at some point, and then computers appeared in my life, and that changed everything basically because I got into computer science. Now I'm here.
What interested you in archaeology?
I don't really know. I think it was really stereotypical stuff, dinosaurs. It was just by the time I brought up this kind of thing. So also we had an old Roman settlement very, very close to where I grew up, and we actually found Roman coins and stuff like that, and so those kind of things were very interesting, but that was really when I was very, very little, like talking about like 10, 12 years old, and then that kind of disappeared.
Tell me about this Roman settlement. What can you remember about that?
It's actually very interesting because the town where I went to high school, it's called Xanten, the only German town with an X, it's actually the only Roman settlement, at least to my knowledge, that is not where the town now is not built on top of the Roman settlement, which is why they were able to excavate everything, and now you can actually go to this Roman village. They reconstructed everything. So Roman history is everywhere there, and basically almost everyone in Germany, I would say, knows this town, Xanten, and has visited it at some point as part of the school project.
Okay.
Going there and visiting how the Romans lived 2,000 years ago.
That was like part of the normal school curriculum, making use of that environment around you?
Yeah, basically, like everyone in Western Germany has done at least one school trip to that particular village, yeah.
The reason I'm thinking about that is one of the things in sustainability is the sort of the notion of place.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always interesting just seeing how place can be used to engage people in, you know, where they are, and thinking about people have been here for a long time.
Mm.
Did it make any of those sorts of connections?
I didn't make them. Now that you say it, that kind of makes sense. It sounds like it's interesting. I mean that's all what history is about, right? Like we ask ourselves where we're coming from, where we're going to, and obviously, as you know, to use this buzzword, as we're moving into a more globalized world, and you know, the world is a witch, that probably changes. And if you look at this history, how maybe in Roman times, 2,000 years ago, there was a time where through the Roman Empire, everything was a bit more connected than the time after that. And now almost coming back to that. Obviously not. It's like super simplifying over generalizing history. But yeah, I guess the notion of place definitely has changed.
So, but you didn't go off to study that. You went off to study computer science?
Yes.
What did you want to achieve with computer science when you started?
I was always into math and those kind of things, like math, biology, physics. I actually have a minor in physics because it was always interesting in how do things work. And math was also very interesting, but I figured out at the time when high school was ending that I had a tendency to solve my math assignments by writing computer programs for that. And then at some point I was like, maybe I should actually go and study that. So I was kind of thinking like, maybe just programming, computer science. Like I had a very naive perception of what that would be. So I went into that. And then in all of undergrad, I was kind of struggling for like, what did I actually want to do? And what is kind of the things that I'm good at? I was actually interested in theoretical math for a bit and figured out I'm not good at that. Like those were not the classes that I was very successful in. And then at some point there was this... I still remember to the very day the first time I ever went into an HSI class, and I was absolutely hooked from the very first moment on. And yeah, from that point on, it's exactly 10 years now. I'm hooked on HSI.
So, what bits of HSI were interesting you? The technology bit or the sociological bit? Something else? Combination?
I would now say the combination. But to be honest, now having obviously perspective is never objective, but having been in the field for some time, I would say back then it was more technological. I guess it's really just the interface aspect, which was what we started learning many things about, you know, user interface design, those kind of very basic HCI things that you start with. And the sociological aspect was actually something that I felt was particularly lacking in my undergrad, as I was doing more technical stuff. Actually, I had a lot of very systems oriented research. I would now say, and we did some studies, but I always felt like there was more. You know, just build the system and then ask 10 users to hey use this and tell me what you think. I didn't feel that was really. Doing justice to what we had developed, and that's why I wanted to do more on the user side, more on the studying people side, and then one thing led to another. So I ended up doing qualitative research. I ended up in sustainability.
So tell me about these one thing leading to another. How did you get there? Because it's quite a thing to get from. You were making tabletops and things.
Yeah, exactly.
It's quite a big thing to get from. What you can tell us about these tabletops for a start.
Yeah, tabletops. We had a lot of interactive tables, and that was back in 2009 when there was a very successful paper coming out. I think it was Kai or Wiss, I'm not exactly sure. At one of the conferences, and it was like. Different technologies to build those interactive tables where people could, you know, do things, and at the same time also those interactive displays started to appear in television shows, and people were using them, and I mean we still see to this day them being used in television, but the research has been done for many, many years. I think it was around the 80s when actually those tabletops started to appear. But they weren't really used in everyday life. And we were wondering, the project that I was involved in, we were wondering, what does it take to actually, you know, give them the kind of exposure that, for example, the iPhone and iPad have? Because also those touch screens, mobile phones, tablets also have been around for quite some time. And at some point, they just took off, and all of a sudden, everyone was using them. We were wondering what does it take to do the same thing for tabletops. So what I did then, I read all this research, literally hundreds of papers, and tried to establish common themes and what have we done, where are we coming from, and how can we learn from from all of this is to not reinvent the wheel and do the same thing over and over as we have done for decades, and move this field a bit further. But like I said, I felt this has been around for so long. It's not really solving any issues. It's not really used in public up to this day. And then I asked Elaine, my advisor in Zurich, when I called her and asked if she had a PhD position open. I want to do research that actually makes a difference. Research that actually solves issues, solves problems in the world, and that feels more than just I'm developing gadgets or I'm doing cool fancy stuff that is nice to show off and gets people's interest, but it doesn't really solve any problems.
So why didn't tabletops take off? The technology is really cool, mm-hmm. and it still is. But I don't have one in my home.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I don't know. I just yesterday talked to people from my old lab. They are still working on them, but they are still not in everyone's lab. And we're also just saying, like I said, you still see them on television. They are being used all the time, just for like they have five different screens, like, you know, like presentation slides on there, and then they just swipe with their hand. But it's always like a little bit dragging, and sometimes they have to swipe twice because the first one doesn't really work. So the usability issues are still there.
Just that they haven't delivered on the promise yet?
So one, maybe, there are many arguments. One argument that has been around in the field for 10 years is similar to the iPhone and the iPad. There needs to be what is often called colloquially the killer app, like the one application that really makes everyone want this, because having a piece of technology in your home, especially such a big and expensive piece of technology, you need a need for that, and there is just no need for tabletops yet. Maybe there will one day. I don't see it right now. I also have to say that I didn't specifically say like I want to exit this realm of research, but I was just at the time when I started, other things seemed to be more worthwhile to pursue for me personally.
So you went in a hunt of things that would make a difference. And what did you find? Yeah.
What did I find? Well, there were a couple of... there was one sustainability project that Elaine said I could start work on, which was looking at what kind of consumer electronics do people buy, and how can we give them information on how to make better informed purchasing decisions? Because we had some information, or back then we thought we had some information on this later on, which turned out to be not the case. So that project kind of slightly changed gears in my PhD. Basically, what I stuck with was kind of studying people's purchasing behavior, like what kind of technology are they buying and why are they buying this, and then there was this entire research area around the rapid replacement cycle, basically. So why do people buy a new mobile phone every year when actually, in theory, there's no reason why it shouldn't work for 5 years. And there's lots of like if you look at it objectively, there's lots of motivation to not buy a new phone because you got accustomed to it, you have all your data on it, it's expensive, and all this kind of stuff. But still, people go on and buy a new iPhone every year or a new I don't know, HTC phone, Samsung phone, whatever every year. So that kind of got me into this obsolescence thing. Obviously, you know, you have this designed obsolescence discussion, which is kind of the sort of paranoid, sort of maybe true assumption that industry is building devices on purpose so that they break after 2 years. You know, there's this colloquial joke usually that a phone has a 2-year warranty, and exactly after 2 years and one day the phone breaks.
Because their business model is entirely determined on selling more stuff.
Exactly.
They have to sell you that new phone.
Exactly.
So even if it doesn't break, they heavily advertise the next one, so you feel quite embarrassed that you've got an old one.
Yeah, and there's social peer pressure, obviously. Like, oh my God, you still have the old phone, like from last year. How dare you? Like, that's unacceptable. You need to have the new phone, 10 SE, whatever.
Now you have this sustainable viewpoint. Is that the, not the killer app, but is that the killer undoing of computing and sustainability? That is so fundamental that we need to sell you a new computer, a new phone. Can we overcome that?
I would argue we can, because the industry itself actually... I see a silver lining there within the industry itself, which is the move from selling devices, selling hardware, to selling services, which you see in all this cloud computing that is coming up. You know, everything is moving into the cloud, everything is moving into... You don't buy a piece of software anymore, but you buy a subscription for a piece of software. And you have all those different income strategies. So maybe those at some point can kind of, for industry, make up for the effect of reduced revenue from selling new devices. I don't know. It's like I said, it's silver lining. It's a little bit of like wishful thinking maybe on my part. But maybe that's the case. I very recently, and just before I came to this conference, read an article that actually there are signs for this rapid replacement cycle slowing down. Like I don't remember the exact figures, but I think there were studies that in the US people were replacing their phones every 14 months on average, and I think that is slightly going down. It's probably down to like something like 17 months. And obviously, at some point, every market is saturated as well. Like I think in 2014, we were producing 1 billion or selling 1 billion phones a year. And at some point, everyone has a phone.
Have they perhaps reached a zenith of the stuff that they can pack into a phone that's useful? So there's not that many more things, perhaps, that they can put into it that's going to make such a big difference to me.
You would think so. I mean, obviously, you know, every phone has a camera right now. Many phones have... I don't know, some kind of like super high precision detection thing, which can even do like fingerprint detection and stuff like that. So if a phone, if the new phone doesn't have any new features besides just being 5% faster, then at some point people might also just be reluctant to buy a new phone because they don't really see the point. So yeah, that could be the case. Obviously, as history has shown us and Moore's Law and all those kind of things that predict that technological advancement will always go on and go on and go on, and there will always be new things. So maybe in 10 years from now there will be a new thing that needs to be in everyone's phone, which proves us wrong.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think about what else are we carrying. I mean, you see those pictures of what the phone has replaced, you know, the desk, yeah, and the typewriter and the camera and everything else, but not carrying that much else.
Yeah,
but I bet there'll be something else, won't there?
Well, I mean, if you told someone in the 80s that every phone once would have a camera, they would be like, why? I don't have a camera with me. Like, ask 100 people in the 80s on the streets if they have a camera with them. I don't think there would be that many people. So the phone, the camera became an essential part of the phone now, even though it hasn't really been something that everyone has carrying with me. So with them. So I think you kind of have to go beyond just what people have on them, but what kind of... what artifacts of technology are you using in your everyday life? Yeah, it is an interesting discussion. It's sort of dangerous because we're kind of doing the job for industry to find the new thing to carry on obsolescence, almost.
Yes, but are we at the point where we can argue that it's not going to carry on? Is it a problem that we can say, actually, that's going to reach its... No. That problem is going to fade away.
You'd
have to be brave to say that, wouldn't you?
Yeah, brave or maybe naive. I don't think just sitting back and waiting for the problem to disappear is a good strategy. I'd rather like to be proactive. Obviously, in my research has been trying to do that. So, yeah, rather than just sitting there and waiting for the problem to be...
So that's what you started with when you went to Zurich. Then where did you go?
Yeah, so like I said, obsolescence is the kind of issue. And then one of the things that I found out that there are so many motivators for people to buy new phones, but what are the motivators for people to actually keep their phones? And then I looked at sustainable HCI research, and there is actually so much in the research domain that already tells us strategies on how to design devices in a way that people don't throw them away as easily. There's lots of stuff about augmentation. So, for example, how can you reuse technology for later on? So we have met some people here at the conference actually who took their old tablet just as an ebook reader, even though it wasn't 100% functional anymore. You can obviously resell devices like a second-hand market. And then my kind of direction of research is rather something about ensoulment or emotional design, as Don Norman called it, or attachment, the ODOM's attachment framework, which is exactly what I'm focusing on. So how can we design devices so that people really get so attached to the particular device that they don't want to replace it? So that's kind of what I was focusing on. And the thing is, like I said, the research has already been done. Like those frameworks exist, but I saw it as my goal of my thesis to bring this to product designers. So that's what I did. I took this framework, this knowledge about how to create attachment, how to foster attachment, and gave this to product designers and asked them to create a piece of consumer electronics, a tablet in particular.
Okay, so emotional design or attachment design, yeah. 101, go.
101?
Yeah.
Well, basically, it has some criteria on how to achieve this. So one of them is, for example, engagement. So if you have a device that, when you use it, it creates some sort of, you're engaged in using it, like you're really, the way how you interact with the device really is fun and enjoyable. That's something. Memories is a strong facilitator for attachment. So when you look at your device and you remember, oh, I've used that at this conference, I've used this on my vacation, and I really don't want to get rid of that because those memories are connected to the device. And we usually don't see this connected to devices, but actually to other physical objects, like there's studies of people like who keep like old cups, for example, with some kind of labels or whatever on them for many decades because they remember them of something. So those are kind of criteria that.
But isn't my attachment to the stuff that's in the device not the device? The photos that I've collected migrate quite happily around my progression of my series of devices.
That is exactly what the difference between the kind of attachment I'm talking about and the attachment that already exists, because marketing has done a great deal of this research, how to foster attachment. But what they are doing is brand attachment, or it's called brand loyalty in marketing speech. And what I'm rather doing is, I sometimes call it device loyalty, because rather than just, I really want this next Samsung phone or Apple phone or iPhone, obviously. I want to keep this particular device. So, for example, that's an idea that came up very recently that someone had on just yesterday. What if a phone would have a casing made out of wood, and then as you use the phone, obviously the wood kind of gets, it gets a different patina, different look and feel, and also like it feels very personalized. So if you were to buy a new phone, yes, you could take the pictures with you and put on the new phone, but it would definitely look different and it wouldn't really feel like your phone. It's kind of like an old wallet, if you have like an old wallet, it's...
Well, I was about to say that what's working for me is that my phone, I'm just holding it up in front of me here looking at it, my phone is attached to my wallet.
Mm.
And for me, that's the thing that's made such a huge difference. Because I used to lose all the time, misplace all the time, both my wallet and my phone.
Mm-hmm.
And having the two things joined together means that it's working for me. And I really, really like this solution. And I've seen others, and there's probably other things that work as well.
Yeah.
For me, this 100% works.
So what are you actually attached to? Are you attached to the wallet or to the phone? Because it looks to me like you could easily just replace the phone and buy a new one as long as it fits the form factor of this particular wallet.
I'm attached to this combo.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
Even though I said it's perfect, but it's not quite perfect. You see here, sorry people on the radio, see here that I've drawn lines here? And those lines are to remind me to, when I put my cards in, I have to put the strip in on that side.
Ah.
Because I went through two or three cycles of putting in them, of losing or breaking cards by putting them in on that side. and having the magnets that hold it close break the magnetic strip.
Oh, there's a magnet in there.
Yeah, there's a magnet that holds that closed like that. But once I fixed that, and maybe that's one of those you know, things about the attachment is that it's I'm able to modify it to suit me.
That is a perfect example of attachment because through customization, because you customize, you personalize this. Like this is not only like some kind of wallet you found and you found really worked really well for you, but you actually modified this to suit your needs. Like you made some, you know, some modifications to it. And even if I had exactly the same one, it wouldn't have those personalized marks there. Or maybe if I make the same discovery and I would put them on there. But this is like not just finding this particular brand of wallet and a particular design, but actually just this one is very individual. Like you
actually wouldn't find annoying, a second one. Actually annoying, you said this particular brand, it's not branded. And that has meant that I can't find a replacement.
Oh my god.
Like I can't go into a shop and say, I want the something something one, because it doesn't appear to exist.
Wow.
I can't find it again.
Which is obviously very difficult for consumer electronics because they're very much
on-brand. Yeah, and there's two things. One of them is it's changed my behavior. It's changed my behavior in two ways. One of them is that the little bit that covered that goes around the corner here on the outside of it moves down. Just as it's aged a bit, it moves down and it covers the camera. So whenever I go to take a photo, I have to remember to do that to move it out the way.
Oh, wow.
So it's only a little thing, but whenever I get somebody else to take a picture with it, I forget to tell them, and the picture has got a big shadow across half of it.
Wow.
But I don't mind, because I remember to do it.
Yeah.
I don't, you know, rarely take a picture that I forget to do it. So it's almost like it's a personalized...
That reminds me of another criterion, which is earned functionality, which is obviously usually prefers more to technological things, but that's kind of like you learn the particular way on how to use the technology in combination with this wallet, which is something that you probably have a certain value assigned to this. Like I know how to use this, and like you said, it doesn't really bother you, so it's kind of fine. But if you were to buy a new wallet and that might have some, or a new phone that would all of a sudden, you know, have a camera slightly positioned slightly elsewhere, and then you would have to, you know, learn a new behavior, learn a new functionality that would kind of be, I would say, off-putting, and maybe it's another reason for you to be very attached to this particular wallet and this phone.
Another thing about it is that it didn't actually suit me at the start, and I had to change my behavior in a significant way because of it. And that is because it doesn't have a place for coins. And it quickly prompted me to avoid coins like the plague. Because I don't have... I end up putting them in other places and pockets and things, and then I, you know, spend them to get rid of them. Because I don't want to carry coins, because it's... I like this, it works for me, except that I had to quite quickly wean myself off coins.
Well, so maybe not too bad. As long as it works.
Maybe I'm talking myself out of this, but it bizarrely works for me. And you mentioned the form factor before. So this is a form factor for an iPhone 5. Not that I've needed an iPhone 6. But if I get an iPhone 6, I also have to replace this.
Yep.
And that is... You know, I imagine if somebody was to give me an iPhone 6, I might solve that problem. But I'm certainly not in a rush because of it.
Yeah, so that's a good point. So actually it's I don't remember one of the designers that we did the study with actually had an idea to that. Maybe I don't off the top of my head I don't recall it, but it would certainly be something that we would go back to have, you know, the kind of that's what I'm looking for. The kind of peripherals that you have, or the like the casings. You know, in the 90s, we had like casings for phones and stuff like that. You could switch out the keyboards and stuff like that. So if we think in those, and now every phone has a bumper like those. I think they call them bumpers for the iPhone. So maybe those kind of things can also be used in combination to create this kind of attachment. Yeah, could be potential.
The companies don't help the situation by changing, primarily for technical reasons, but for example, that when they change the big plug on the on the iPhone and the iPad to a little one, to the Lightning adapter, the microphone that we're currently talking through has got an adapter, and for some reason they still haven't provided a Lightning adapter for that.
Oh, wow.
For that device. So I have sellotaped to the output from the microphone the adapter to go into the Lightning. So I'm kind of like, this microphone works for me. It's much, much better than the microphone on the iPad itself.
Right.
So where did that lead you, that work?
Where did it lead me? Well, now I'm finishing my work, as I'm writing up, it's kind of a double-edged sword. It's kind of very interesting because obviously it's both very interesting and very, very well received. Like even at previous conferences, I've met people from industry who actually said this is very interesting. But at the same time, it's also very challenging because I always come across those arguments as like, you know, it's kind of like this dilemma that yes, attachment is great, and probably the like people want to be attached to their personal belongings, especially something as expensive as a phone. But also like the industry and economy kind of works against that. So that's kind of the dilemma I'm facing. But In my future work, I would say, or in my outlook, I kind of take on this provocative stance that maybe this is all changing in the future. Hopefully, I'd say, as I said before, with the more and more upcoming services structure that we're moving more into companies providing services rather than just hardware.
Those deals that you can get, certainly in New Zealand. And I've seen them in the UK, so presumably they're wider, where instead of buying a phone, you buy the phone service with the company. The advantage of doing that is that they promise continual upgrades.
Mm-hmm.
So the only way that they have moved to that phone as a service is by doing what we would think is the wrong thing.
By giving you an entirely new phone every year, you say. Yeah, right. So obviously that's not what I'm thinking of. What I'm thinking of is more like the project of like the entire area of modular phones, which have been proposed, I think, first time 10 years ago. But more recently, we've really seen them coming up more and more and also be more successful. Like the Fairphone is just one of them. It's like the very popular one. But there's Phone Blocks, there's Project Aura. There's like a couple of phones that are coming up and kind of offering those modular things. So I guess we were looking at this, and rather than just giving you an entirely new phone, they would give you the option to, you know, you have the subscription-based thing. If a new phone comes out, we promise you we'll just give you, like, I don't know, the high-resolution screen, and you can switch it. And obviously, the best way would be if you could switch it yourself, because what else would give you more satisfaction than if you could replace something in your phone yourself, rather than just send it somewhere and you get a new phone back or you get a new part of the phone back. So I think again, here it's something where we don't know what the future holds. I certainly think, or I certainly hope that it goes into this direction, that it's into the modular phones instead of just replacing entire devices.
Is this the work that you are extracting these sorts of themes and calling them as patterns?
Yeah, I think there is a lot of patterns in there, because as you said, like moving entirely into services, have modular phones, have reuse of phones, so you give it to someone else after you personally are not using it anymore for whatever reason. Maybe augmenting a device by by using it for something beyond its intended purpose after, you know, some of the functionality breaks. Maybe you can use the tablet as a picture frame on your cupboard. So there are a variety of patterns in there that I see emerging that could be potentially very useful for us in the future.
So you initially started out stumbling into computer programming by solving your maths problems with computer programming. Are we going to be able to solve sustainability problems with computer programming?
Good question, difficult question. I don't know if... I don't think that's a yes or no answer here. But I think... I often like to say we are not... We are part of the problem, and that's why I think we have an obligation to be part of the solution. Because if you look at this conference here, there are 3,700 people, I think, around here, and they're all striving for innovation. They're all, or not all of them, but many of them are striving to find the new technological development that you know, brings HCI, human-computer interaction, as a field forward, that brings computer science forward, new technologies being developed. And this kind of obviously contributes to obsolescence, because as we've talked about before, you know, 20, 30 years ago, no one would have thought a camera would be in a mobile phone. Maybe in 20 years from now, we have something in our pockets that doesn't look at all like the mobile phone, but it's something that is super obvious and we all need then. And maybe that's something that is appearing here now in computing research. And that's why I think we are part of the problem. We are kind of, this obsolescence is sort of brought upon the society by our computing community, and that's why I think we need to try to address this issue and solve it.
I thought of an app that we don't have yet, and that's if we could take a pill and be filled up with some nanobots. And that it be continually monitoring our health from the inside, and our phone, you know, be connected to medical specialists and have AI and stuff, and it looked after us.
Yeah.
That's a compelling reason for buying a new phone.
Because
I'm sorry, even if I like the device, that would be a thing that would say, sorry, old device, you're gone. So are we kidding ourselves?
Maybe we are. I don't know. Very related to what you mentioned, there's actually a piece of research that actually talks about, I think they're called insertables, I don't know, like things you put under your skin, like you know, like we're almost turning ourselves into robots. As one of my undergrad instructors at HCI used to say, there isn't a human 2.0. We can always change technology, we can't change humans. Maybe that's not exactly true, because maybe the future will actually be, oh my God, I don't even want to think about that, but maybe it's something like that. But I don't know if I want to upgrade something that's, you know, embedded in my skin every year, even if I have it.
Would hurt.
Yeah, exactly. So, nope, rather
but
not.
But as we get closer to that sort of cyborg thing, we're going to be more attached to it, because
yes.
It's me.
Yeah, it's a part of us.
I mean, maybe that's where I'm going with my wallet. It feels like it's mine. It's part of my identity.
It certainly
does. Or for me
does.
Anyway, not, I mean, other people might not recognize it.
It certainly does, yeah. I hope as... I hope that we're going into a future where we don't replace this technology all the time. And maybe also, I don't know, it's the same discussion we have about peak oil, that, you know, in 20 years from now, we don't have enough oil anymore for the entire world. The problem is we have been saying this for 50 years from now. So maybe the same thing happens at some point to some of the materials we are using in technology, that we run out of them. It doesn't really look like that, but maybe at some point we will be forced, for reasons of availability of resources, to change our entire production cycles of those things.
If you could either go back in time or change it for the people that are doing now, what would you change in your undergrad education? Would it have been beneficial And would it be beneficial for the wider crowd to have more sociological work, earth systems? Is it worth trying to get that into computer science?
I think so. I have to be honest, when I started my undergrad, I had to pick a minor. It was called application subject or something like that. And one of them was psychology. And I was like, what's the connection between computer science and psychology? I totally didn't see that. And obviously, once I took HCI courses, I was like, yes, I see the connection. I want to change. And I couldn't change anymore because the European system changed to Bologna. And there was lots of political reasons involved. So I struck with physics, which is obviously very different to psychology. But now I see this. And I personally would have liked this. So I personally would say, yes, it would be great if we would give everyone more... at least the option to more realize how much this all backfeeds into the society, like what we do in terms of technological advancement. It also might change society for the worse or for the better. We don't know. The thing is that I don't really know if many people see it that way, especially in undergrad when you start, like me, very naive. You start and you want to program stuff. You study computer science for a reason. Not everyone is really interested in this. Not everyone really wants to do this. So I think it would be great to have more sociology and those kind of things in the curriculum. But how? That's a challenge. How to get people hooked on that?
Maybe we need to get better at selling those connections to psychology and whatever else to computer science in this case. But yes. Then there's the challenge you just raised, is that the students want to be doing computer science.
Yep.
Like you, they'll say, what's the relevance of this?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Do you think that there's a killer app out there for sustainability?
Maybe, but if so, I don't see it. if I saw it, I would be developing it. I would go home and start developing it, but I don't really see it, unfortunately.
We're writing a book of these interviews. We're calling it Tomorrow's Heroes, looking at, as if we were looking back at people that are doing good, and let's describe those as heroes, even if people don't want to be described as heroes, we're doing it anyway. How would you see your sustainable superpower? What's the special thing that you're bringing to this?
Oh wow, that's a lot of responsibility put on one. Well, obviously, as I'm writing my PhD thesis, it all comes down to the question, like, summarize a thesis in one sentence. I guess, like I said, I think the research is already there, but just trying to connect the research that's out there to practitioners that then apply this in everyday life and in product design, hopefully, at some point, that would probably be what I would say, although obviously like you said, I wouldn't really be liked it to be called like heroes or superpower.
What's the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years? You've almost written your thesis
in terms
of the
research.
Success of getting to there. I think that is a success. I'm gonna name it for you. I think getting to that point of saying, right, I'm writing this, it's nearly done.
Yeah, I mean, it took me quite a while to find a spot in research where I really feel like, okay, that's kind of resonating with the community. And the problem is when you're doing a PhD, you're doing this work, you're looking at it every day for years, and you're kind of like, everything is so obvious. Like this is so obvious. What am I doing here? Like, I'm just stating the obvious things. And then you talk to other people, and at some point they're like, oh, that's really interesting, and that's. And they show sincere interest in this kind of work. Like, I think identifying those kind of spots, and obviously that culminates in a PhD, so yeah, I would agree.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
I would love to say yes, but I have to say no.
Okay, there's two questions in there. Why would you love to say yes, and why do you have to say no?
Because I feel like we need more activists, we need more action. Like I said before, like just sitting back and waiting for things to happen to turn out to be better isn't really what we should do. But it's just more convenient to do exactly that. So could do so much more besides my research, obviously.
What motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
Wow. That depends, is it a work day or an evening or a weekend? I think one of the great things about doing a PhD is that you're doing work that you really enjoy. And I think that is kind of something, like I'm always have something that I look forward to. That's actually one of the things that kept me from writing in the past few months. I have so many other things that are so much more interesting. Obviously, everything else is much more interesting than writing up this piece of research.
Including doing the dishes.
Yeah, everything. Yeah. Cleaning your house, top to bottom, yeah.
What's the biggest challenge you're looking forward to in the next couple of years?
In my personal life or in general?
Whatever you like.
Figuring out what to do next, honestly, that's kind of the thing. Like, because I have no idea where I'm going to be in 1 year from now.
If you could wave a magic wand and have a miracle occur by the time we wake up tomorrow morning in San Jose time, what would that be?
Just one. We talked about so many problems here, and we had this great workshop over the past 2 days where we had about 100 problems that we put on the wall. Solving some of them would be awesome. I'm not going to go for the very cliche like world peace, but you know, something like, obviously I have a vested interest in my PhD research, so solving some of those issues with just a magic wand would be amazing. Yeah.
And lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners?
I have, you know, think, act responsibly, think responsibly. Maybe just be aware of what your actions are and what they imply.
Thank
like,
you.
Like I said, activism is a big thing here, but it takes a lot of commitment.
Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
You've been listening to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher and me, Samuel Mann. We're broadcast on Otago Access Radio, oar.org.nz, and podcast on sustainablelens.org. On sustainablelens.org, we are building up a searchable archive of conversations with people from many different fields who are applying their skills to a sustainable future. In our conversations, we try to find out what motivates them and what it means to see the world through a sustainable perspective, through their sustainable lens. Tonight's sustainable lens was that of Christian Remy from the University of Zurich. You can follow the links on Sustainable Lens to find us on Facebook, and you can listen to Sustainable Lens via iTunes for free and all the other poddy sorts of places. That was Sustainable Lens. I'm Samuel Mann. I hope you enjoyed the show.
At Otago Polytechnic, we've made a commitment to sustainability in all that we do. High quality, hands-on education is our trademark, and it's delivered with a focus on sustainable practice. We even have a school dedicated to it, our Centre for Sustainable Practice. For more information, check out our website, otagopolytechnic.ac.nz. A bright future is a sustainable future. Otago Polytechnic. Proud sponsor of Sustainable Lens.
This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.